Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 50, recorded on January 17, 2011. Networked Media Mayhem. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ford, introducing the all-new 2012 Ford Focus Electric with voice-activated sync and MyFord Touch. Featuring gas-free power, zero CO2 emissions, and battery management technology that lets you go the distance. Learn more at focuselectricpower.com. And by MailRoute, which protects you from spam and viruses, simplifies your life, and makes your email usable again. MailRoute has added a new service for individual users, less than $30 per year for single users. Visit MailRoute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Tom and Leo use. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheater.com. This week's guest geek is Barb Gonzalez, a.k.a. the Simple Tech Guru, who specializes in explaining technology to the average consumer, especially networked media players and streamers, which she writes about on About.com. Not only that, she's my very first female geek, or might I say geekette, to appear on the show. Hey, Barb, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott, and it's a privilege to be your first female geek.
I'm very happy to have you here, and I hope you're the first of many. For those who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, can post questions for Barb, and I'll pass on as many as I can. So, Barb, as a female geek, you are in a little bit of a minority, I think. Most girls don't gravitate towards technology as they're growing up. How'd that happen to you?
Well, it started when my brother used to drag me to the Pacific Stereo stores to listen to the different speakers. He didn't have anybody else to take with him, so he would point out, you know, listen to the highs on that and listen to the lows and listen to the mid-range and all that sort of stuff. But I also was a photographer from the time I was about 12, so between the photos and the audio, it was just natural to kind of get into video, and made videos when I was in high school and went on to a career in the movie and television industry when I got out of college for about a dozen years or so.
Mm-hmm. And what were you doing there in the movie and TV industry?
A lot of times I was working for the studios, supervising production on films and television. You know, everything from Ghostbusters 2 and Flatliners to Awakenings to a lot of really cool shows. Started out with shows like Hill Street Blues, believe it or not.
Wow, that's some time ago, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
You must have been a child in the business then.
Yeah. Work permits or something. I know. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. So then after that, of course, you became a journalist, and you've been writing for a wide variety of publications, including Home Theater off and on. You and I did some projects together with Home Theater. As I recall, they were TV face-offs. We would sit in front of a big bank of TVs and judge each one and so on.
Yeah, and I also wrote two books. I wrote the Home Electronics Survival Guide and Home Theater Made Simple, just to make it simple for people to understand how to use technology. And I kind of was one of the first people out there saying, this is not easy. How is somebody going to put a home theater together?
And a very useful service that is, too. And those books are available on your website, simpletechguru.com, if I'm not mistaken.
They're kind of outdated. You can get them through, you can get the Home Electronics Survival Guide through Amazon. And there will probably be a new version of Home Theater Made Simple coming out later this year.
Excellent.
But, yeah.
Good. Well, I know how much work that is, because I've written a couple books myself, and that's a lot of work, so I wish you all the best for that.
Thanks.
So let's get into network media players. And I'd love for you to explain the difference between a network media player and a streamer.
I think that there's just a little bit of a difference between the two. Some some websites are just starting to call everything a media streamer, but a network media player might actually have on board a hard drive, or it may actually connect straight to your computers. I believe a network media player is something that more connects to your own media, and the media streamers is more looking for the content over online and over the air, you know, through the internet and that sort mm-hmm. of stuff. Things like Netflix or Hulu and that sort of stuff. Although, you know, if it's connecting to your home network, it might be streaming. It's just not enough just to call it a network media streamer. I think that some of them have to be called a player because you've got that hard drive in it, so you're not streaming at that point.
Right, exactly. I would assume that a lot of boxes tend to combine those two functions.
Absolutely.
Some of them anyway. So let's go over some of the different systems. I think you've had experience with just about all of them, have you not?
Everything except the funny thing is that I've had Boxy on my computer, but I've not actually gotten my hands on a Boxy box. But other than that, I've gotten just about everything else.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit, summarize your experience with Roku, Vudu, Apple TV.
You're trying to prod the monster, aren't you? Well, I have to say, some of them have better quality picture. You know, all of them have different content partners. Some are able to have Hulu and Netflix, and others aren't. Some only have Netflix and some of the other online Amazon and demand and all that sort of stuff. So there's all kinds of differences that way. Apple TV and Western Digital's Live Hub are two of the absolute best quality pictures and easiest to use that I've seen out there. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, should we talk about Roku now?
We should, yes. At some point, we should talk about Roku.
Is this the time to give the bad news about Roku?
Yeah. Now, I have to say in preface, that Leo really likes Roku, and I suspect it's probably because that it might be easier to use, certainly than Google TV. He's not a big Google TV fan because he found it not very easy to use. But I think what you're talking about is picture quality, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I am talking about picture quality. I am talking about, you know, when you have all of these lined up, which one is really the easiest user interface? Mm-hmm. And, you know, just quality of the piece itself.
You're not a big Roku fan. Tell us why.
Okay, I am not a big Roku fan. The first part of it is that Roku is very proprietary about the way you set it up. So a lot of times when you're setting things up with content providers like Netflix and Flickr and all that sort of thing, you might have to go to their websites and do this activation code and everything. But you could do it kind of at your leisure if you do the Netflix and Hulu and everything. You just register all your devices. With Roku, every time you go to open up a new content provider, you have to go to their page to set it up. So it's a little bit more confusing. It's a little odd. And it's just cumbersome. I stopped adding new content because I was tired of going to their page every single time. And a lot of them require, a lot of these, you know, there's a lot of partners that one of the things that they advertise is how much content there is, like 200 channels. But again, remember the days when we first had 200 channels on satellite, there was nothing on. Well, this is kind of right. The same thing.
Right. You know, the Bruce Springsteen song, I think, was 57 channels and nothing on, or 500 channels and nothing
exactly.
on.
Exactly. It's terrible with the content. I mean, how many times am I going to watch Buddhist TV? You know, maybe once.
You know, I'd kind of be interested in that myself.
Get very zen-like every day. I'm not
right,
sure.
Right, exactly.
So that's one of it. I mean, they say they have a lot of content, but is it content you're really going to watch? And it isn't really as easy to set up. There really are I just think that there's easier ones. I'm in love with the WDTV Live Hub that has a very easy interface that makes complete sense. And it's a hub, so it actually could be a media server for other devices that you have in your home. You could put all of your stuff on it. It's got 1 or 2 terabytes.
It's like a NAS. It's like a network-attached storage.
Exactly. It has NAS capabilities. It is a beautiful picture. It has no problem. It has actually some substance, so it doesn't feel like something, if you put something on top of it, it's going to break. Mm. It's easy to set up. It's a beautiful picture. And I've talked to the Roku people at CES, and I have to think that people like Leo and everybody else could not possibly have the experience that I had with the Roku box I had, because it was the worst picture I have ever seen on any kind of device. It had jitter. It had jaggies on the edges. It had my son, when we were going to go watch a Netflix movie and I had it connected, he's like, oh, please, Mom, just go to the TV Netflix. Do not use Netflix from the Roku, because it would just jitter and get out of focus. So I have to think that I have a bad one. But what does that
maybe,
go to
maybe
say?
An older one? Have you had it for a while? Oh, maybe it didn't get updated or something?
Brand new, all updated. It's not that. It could be the device itself. That's the only thing I can think of, because I did see them having it set up at CES. But, you know, it's a $59 device. And if you want it because it's small, go for the WDTV Live Plus, which is just the same size. A little bit easier to use. Doesn't have all the content partners, but is DLNA, and you can send things to it from your computer. It can pick things up from your computer. And that's the other thing about Roku, is that while they might have an app that kind of looks around for all of your media, it doesn't really find it and doesn't play as many of the file formats as the other boxes do. I'm just really... I know people buy it, and I just think it's really about the hype, and that people have heard the name Roku because it was the first one to have Netflix. Now, everything has Netflix. I think I even saw a refrigerator or something with it, but I'm only kidding.
At CES, that's right. I think Samsung had Netflix on its refrigerator, or LG maybe. I've got a number of questions in the chat room regarding this, and they echo my own question that I was going to ask you, which is, so Netflix, for example, looks different from the Roku box versus, say, one of the apps on one of the TVs that you might buy. Is that correct?
Well, looking different in a couple ways. One is the quality of how well it comes through, whether it picks up the HD. You know, I've got a very fast internet, which made me surprised why we had problems. I have like 65 megabits per second, so I always should be able to get HD coming through, the Roku box couldn't handle it. The other thing is that there are different versions of Netflix on different boxes. Some of them allow you to actually find media, and I think that the Roku box does. And some of them you can't even remove media. You can only play what you have. That amount of control is different on each of the different boxes, from a Sony Blu-ray player to the Samsung TV to the Roku box. They all have different versions.
That's so weird. I would think they would all just connect to the same website, the same cloud server in this case, and you'd basically get the same content at the same resolution, but apparently not. I mean, what you're describing with the Roku box with jittering and jaggies and so on sounds to me, I don't know, but it sounds to me like, a different type of compression being used, more compression being used with Roku else.
I mean, I have noticed on other boxes as well, how well does it might say it does 1080p, but I mean, you being in home theater, you know that up converting things from 480 or even just passing through the 1080, it depends on the processor.
True enough. That's absolutely true. So these different boxes, Max11 in the chat room asks, which devices give you the best Netflix picture quality? You seem to be a big Western Digital fan. Are you getting good picture quality on that box?
Absolutely. I get nothing but great picture quality from that Western Digital stuff. I just connected a Sirago, and that had some nice picture quality. I actually find that the best picture quality is the embedded, like the Netflix that's right on the Samsung TV, straight on the Samsung TV. Mm. And the Apple TV does it absolutely sensationally. It's just beautiful.
And what about the apps on the Blu-ray players from Samsung or so on? Are they equivalent to what you get in the TV?
Yeah, absolutely. The LG and the, well, I got to say, the LG and the Samsung, absolutely gorgeous. The Netflix on the Sony Blu-ray player that I recently tried out. Again, it was kind of an older version or a strange version of Netflix. Maybe they just want you to use their Curiosity on Demand thing or something, but it wasn't quite as good a quality. Actually, I also did use the Seagate GoFlex this week, and that one did really nicely on the Netflix as well.
Wow. So it sounds like these hard drive companies, Western Digital, Seagate, Sirago, is that a hard drive company primarily? I don't know that company.
I don't really. I just got their device. I think that they're really specific to network media players. They also, one of the things that's special about them is that they also have a built-in DVR. Now,
very nice.
Well, it only records 480, of course.
Oh, man.
Well, you're not going to get HD. Come on. I mean, won't even go into the whole turning off of the analog component video out stuff.
Right.
It can do that, but I think you'd have to be pretty desperate to use that function, actually.
Does it do that over the air? It records over the air or
whatever you hook into it. It records from cable or satellite. It says that it can record from a VHS or, you know, anything that you can put in with a composite. It doesn't do anything in terms of finding a program or using a guide or anything like that. It just is going to record at a time for a specific length of time, and you have to change your channel and stuff. What was really funny to me was that it actually had a way for you to choose the quality from HQ to LP to SP. Remember that from the VHS days?
I do remember that. Wow.
I'm aging myself again. Oh, no.
Oh, no. Listen, before we continue, and there's so much more to talk about, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode of Home Theater Geeks, Ford, introducing the all-new 2012 Ford Focus Electric with voice-activated sync with My Ford Touch. The 2012 Ford Focus Electric is an all-electric vehicle without a gasoline engine. It's powered by a lithium-ion battery with a high-voltage capacity, even higher than the Ford hybrid electric and plug-in hybrid vehicle batteries. And it's recharged by plugging it into a 120-volt outlet or even a 240-volt outlet. And it has a regenerative braking system, which enables you to capture the braking energy. I think this is very cool. And I'm really glad to see it being used in these new electric cars. It provides you with more than enough driving power between charges for most work commutes and getting around town. And it may provide cheaper operation, because electricity is often cheaper than gasoline, so it's less costly to operate, especially if it's charged at night when electricity rates are lower. The all-new 2012 Ford Focus Electric features sync with My Ford Touch, which I've had some experience with recently myself, and it's really cool. It responds to voice command and touch controls for battery management, entertainment, climate control, phone, and navigation. So you can easily make calls, play music, manage your battery, and more. Sync understands more than 10,000 voice commands in total, so you can stay connected while keeping your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel. To learn more, visit FocusElectricPower.com. That's FocusElectricPower.com. And thanks to Ford for supporting our special coverage of CES 2011, which is now behind us, and we had a wonderful time there. Barb, you were there as well.
Absolutely.
And I bet your dogs were barking by the end as much as mine were.
I had a lot of appointments, so I was trying to keep them all together, you know.
Yeah. I try to be efficient that way, too. And in fact, I tried to schedule my appointments, you know, to go from one end of the hall to the other doesn't always work, I'm afraid.
No. Do we want to talk a little bit about what I saw at CES? Are you interested
in
that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, what did you see?
Well, my area of expertise, the network media players and network TVs, were really hot this year. I mean, super just trying hot. To keep up with that, just I couldn't even look at anything else.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you see that was very exciting? What was most exciting to you?
Well, there's a lot of things that are exciting. A 3D Vudu. I can't wait for 3D Vudu. That's going to be coming in just the next couple of weeks.
Oh,
you know,
man.
The Vudu on demand service that is on LG and Mitsubishi, and the Boxy service is going to have Vudu as well. And it's going to be in 3D in a couple of weeks. So finally, well, we can get some kind of content.
Right. We got that. We did see a demo of that in the LG booth, as I recall.
Yep. And Mitsubishi had a demo as well.
Oh, okay.
And the fun thing is that the Boxy box from D-Link is actually in, is actually the menu is actually in 3D.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, so that's pretty fun.
Yeah,
so
no kidding.
I can't wait for that to come out.
And, wow, okay, cool.
And then, of course, the other thing that was really out there was how about apps to have your cable come from a cloud online instead of from, you know, a cable box.
You know, Time I Warner heard about that.
Comcast.
Time Warner, right?
And Comcast as well.
Ah.
Time Warner is doing both Sony and Samsung, and I think Comcast is just doing Samsung. But but you can watch your live TV. There's a lot of questions I have, and so I wouldn't go into a lot of this because I got different explanations from the different people on the floor, but it's going to be really interesting. I mean, you know, I guess if you can't beat them, join them, right? You know,
now this brings up the question of content providers and source devices like TVs, Blu-ray players, Roku boxes, and so on. Mm-hmm. They all have certain content providers available to them, and there is some crossover, but nobody has everything. Am I correct?
Nope. I don't think so. I don't think everybody has everything. I think they pay licensing fees and things. Plus, it would just be, I mean, why would you want to have Blockbuster on demand and Amazon on demand and, I guess, Alpha Line from Sears? I mean, basically, they're the same service even.
Really? I mean, I would think that maybe you could, I would think maybe, you know, Amazon might have a movie that Blockbuster didn't or vice versa. And so it might be a good idea to have both.
I'm not really seeing that, you know, everything from Vudu to, I mean, Vudu's its own service, you know, and now it's owned by Walmart. But then there's the Sears and the Blockbuster and a couple of others that are coming out. They're all run by Roxio Now. So they're actually just a skin on top of Roxio Now. So they're the same service. And all of them they'll offer a movie to buy as a video, you know, on video on demand, so that if you can download it right away, like Salt came out a few weeks ago, but you have to wait like up to 28 days for to actually be able to rent it. That way, somehow the film companies think that they're making more money by doing it that way. I'm not quite sure how.
What's the difference between streaming, which doesn't stay then resident on your local hard drive, versus downloading? Which services are taking which approach, or is that sort of an irrelevant thing anymore?
Well, actually, it is totally relevant. It's actually what we were talking about. I wrote about that on about.com. People can do a search on streaming versus downloading. What it is, for anybody who doesn't know, streaming is just going to do a little bit of a buffer and then, you know, you'll see it as it goes. Downloading
as it comes in over your internet connection.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then downloading, you actually have to have some kind of hard drive. So if you have a TV, you're not going to be able to download to the TV because it doesn't have memory. You need to have memory to actually download that file. And the thing about it is, when you're when you're buying something, you're going to download it because you want to have it and save that file for later, right? When you're renting it, you will have a choice between downloading it and then watching it in a 24-hour period, or starting to download it and or streaming straight away. If you've got something that's a real high-definition file, especially something like Vudu with their HDX sound that is a real big file, you might want to, especially if you have a slower connection, you're going to want to download it. You're going to say, okay, I want to watch Iron Man tonight with a great sound. I think I'm going to start downloading it now so that later on I'm not going to have any kind of jittery or interference from not having a strong enough web connection.
Right.
Fast enough web connection.
Right. So you can start downloading it. And then I've always been confused by the idea of downloading to own, because then it sits on your hard drive presumably forever, but it takes up space and prevents you from downloading other stuff. Is there any way to offload it, say, to a Blu-ray recordable, or are they? I'm assuming that copy protection fears would pretty much prevent that, anybody from allowing that.
Legally, I think that they have that pretty covered. You know, I wanted to test it out just for curiosity's sake, not because I actually want to be illegal about it. But I haven't been able to actually see if I could take something from a Vudu or some other place yet. I haven't done that yet. If you download it to your computer, most of it, other than, of course, the copy-protected iTunes movies. If you buy an iTunes movie, you're only going to be able to play it through an Apple TV. And that's actually because you're not actually moving the file. It's just kind of being streamed through the Apple TV and Home Share. But if you have other files, there's ways of kind of moving them around. And I'm still really experimenting at how much you can do that, but mostly it's only going to be if you save it to your computer. You buy it and save it to your computer. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing is Amazon On Demand will let you download the movies in different places. You absolutely cannot even stream them if they're on a device. You can't stream them to your computer or other devices, but you can connect to it because it's always available on your Amazon On Demand library. Mm-hmm. You have to try it out to check it out. So you own it, but it lives kind of in the cloud more than it lives really on your hard drive. So it kind of saves hard drive space. But, you know, these things have 2 terabytes of space now, you know. And you can also connect an external drive to it. So
this is, in fact, one of the questions in the chat room from Beat, who asks, he wonders if Samsung, I guess he's heard that Samsung has USB ports for hard disks on I guess some of their Blu-ray players, maybe their TVs too. Have you seen a growing trend towards being able to hang a hard drive off of some of these devices?
Almost all of them, except for that Roku box I have.
But okay,
some of the higher end Roku boxes. I always say when you're looking for a network media player to make sure that it has at least 2 USB connections. And you want to know why?
Please tell. Oh, do tell.
Well, for one, you want to have one so that you can extend and play some, like if you have all your media libraries on a hard drive, usually you can connect that. And at that point, you're not streaming again. You're actually just playing straight from that external hard drive. And you want to have a second one because many of them allow you to connect a USB keyboard or a USB wireless keyboard, which means that you can now sit on your couch and not have to do the up, down, right, left, you know, virtual keyboard. You can actually just type things in.
Which is a pain in the ass for me. I hate that up, down, right, left, you know, trying to type on that thing. On the other hand, the keyboard paradigm is a little problematic, isn't it, with this sort of thing? Because, of course, as we know, computers are a lean forward, or some people call it a 2-foot experience, whereas TV is a lean back or 10-foot experience. And it seems that ne'er the twain shall meet, almost. So having a keyboard on your lap to type in URLs or names of movies you want to search for, or actors or whatever. I've always thought that was a good idea, but it doesn't seem to ever gain any traction in the marketplace.
Well, actually, you're kind of talking about a couple different things.
Okay.
So if you're talking about actually looking at your desktop on your computer, right? Your desktop computer on your television set.
Okay.
Then you're looking at those little tiny words and trying to fit it into a URL.
Mm.
If however, you're looking at the 10-foot experience, like the user interfaces, the menus on the network media players and such, you're getting those big words. So when you're typing it in, they don't get small. I mean, you're just typing it in instead of using that virtual keyboard that you see that you have to point to and go up and down and get all the letters from.
Yeah, that's no good.
So it's like having that 10-foot experience, but you have a keyboard. It's just very, very cool. Now, I also want to mention that some of the new smarter TVs, LG and Samsung in particular, in this coming year, will have web browsers. And the cool thing about having a web browser that's an app or part of the TV is that you don't have that, again, see the desktop on your TV where it's all really tiny. You're actually getting a web browser that's made for the 10-foot experience. It's much better experience.
Wow, that does sound interesting, something I would like to explore myself. And that brings up the one other question of many I have for you, which is the user interface. You have the user interface of the player or streamer box, and then you have the interface of the content provider. So it almost seems to me like a double layer. How do they resolve themselves, or do they come into conflict?
Wow, okay, so I'm trying to picture things. I mean, like I said, the Netflix has its user interface, and Hulu.
Maybe the box itself doesn't, its own internal user interface doesn't get in the way unless you are configuring it or something. Maybe it's a non-issue.
It's totally a non-issue, because what happens is you use the user interface of the box to get into the program. Mm. And at that point, it's like drilling down to another menu. So you might, depending on, like, let's say Netflix, for example, because like I said, it's got so many different user interfaces once you get into it. Sometimes it's just one box after another, you know, you just kind of go through like a carousel, and other ones, like on Apple TV, has a wall of all of the cover art, you know, which makes it a much easier experience. And I think actually the Roku uses that one as well, and gives you lots of suggestions that you can go through. But once you click on Netflix, that comes up, and that, I mean, there's not usually like there's not a skin around it or anything else. It just kind of comes up.
Mm. Okay.
Did I answer that question?
You did. You did, absolutely. Okay. The one other question before I get to something else I have to do, which is, you've played with Google TV, have you not?
Yes.
What is your impression of Google TV?
Good idea. But here's the thing is that what Google TV promised, they can't deliver because they don't have Netflix and they don't have an ABC, NBC, CBS, Hulu.
Or Hulu, I think. Yeah.
Right. They don't have any of that. So the idea of being able to look for a TV show and having it show it to you when it's going to be on your TV, you know, on your cable or satellite, as well as showing you all the places you can find it online or watch it online, it doesn't work because they don't have the partnerships that they had hoped to have. So it's sort of a very fancy way right now to just find things on your, you know, when the upcoming shows that are coming up. And now they're going to be kind of falling behind because other things like Search All through the new Samsung TVs will have a thing called Search All, which is going to do what Google was promising to do. But they have a lot of strong people behind them, including Intel. And so they're not going away yet.
A lot of people were complaining about the difficulty of setting it up, and the user interface wasn't as smooth and easy as it should have been. I haven't had a chance to play with it yet, so I'm not going to render my own opinion, but I know you have, and so what your experience is very valuable.
Well, I got the Logitech Review, which is the kind of set-top box. Mm-hmm. It gave very easy directions on how to set it up. I had mm-hmm. no problem. It walked me through everything. So it wasn't a problem there. It is kind of funky the way that you go back and you have home screens that are on top of your, whatever you're watching on TV in the background. And I kind of get a little lost sometimes.
Maybe is that dual interface, kind of the overlaid interface thing that I was mentioning earlier.
Yeah, I think that if there's somebody who's got that, it's the whole Google TV thing. And where is the application? I'm not quite sure I understand what's going on, again, because part of it doesn't have the partners it needs to. But once you decide you want Napster and you click on Napster, you get Napster. Mm. It's that. But, the search on top of things and stuff, I think that the different manufacturers need to be careful of doing that kind of on top of the see-through opaque screen that's on top of things. I think that makes it a little bit more confusing and such. Mm-hmm. So, on the other hand, my boyfriend, who is not into remote controls, but he likes, he is a writer, so he uses a keyboard, is more comfortable actually using the Logitech keyboard as his remote control than a regular remote control.
That's very hilarious. Here we have a female geek who is very comfortable with remote controls and a male partner who isn't.
Yeah, well, it's kind of our inside joke.
Yes, indeed. Well, there's much more to talk about, and we have a little bit more time. So if you'll forgive me for just one moment, I'd like to take a moment to thank our other sponsor for this episode, MailRoute. Businesses of every size use MailRoute. One user or 50,000 users, it doesn't matter. MailRoute protects you from spam and viruses, simplifies your life, and makes your email usable again. MailRoute is a secure hosted service that filters virus and spam for companies of any size. Whether you're a single user or a company with tens of thousands of employees, MailRoute can eliminate viruses and spam, reduce the load on your email server, lower your costs, and make your email usable again. Typical MailRoute customers see a 95% reduction in their inbound email volume with virtually no false positives. I know that Leo loves MailRoute. He's been using the service for his domains for more than 6 years. And MailRoute has been his top choice for spam and virus filtering all along. Twit host Tom Merritt started using MailRoute, and we know he can use email domains that he'd given up on being able to use as hopeless. Tom Johnson, the founder and CEO of MailRoute, started one of the very first companies in this market back in 1988, FrontBridge. FrontBridge was acquired by Microsoft in 2005 and still offers as the Microsoft Exchange hosted services line. Tom wasn't done, though, and he had too many good ideas that he couldn't stand to see go to waste, which is why he started MailRoute, the next generation service for filtering email with a level of accuracy and a price that's unmatchable. There's nothing easier for mail filtering than MailRoute, and there's no hardware or software to install. You just sign up with MailRoute and then change the MX records for your domain to start your mail flowing through them. And then they do all the work for you. Visit MailRoute.info for sign up. As a Twit listener, you'll receive a 10% discount for the life of your account. Small business accounts start at just $2 per user per month for 10 users. And because of on-demand because of the demand from the Twit Army, MailRoute has added a new service for individual users as well. Less than $30 a year for single users. Visit MailRoute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Tom and Leo use. So, Barb.
Scott.
The one issue I want to get back to, I want to cover before we finish up here in the next 10 minutes or so, is moving all of this content around your house. You've got streaming coming in. You've got a NAS hard drive sitting there with tons of content. But of course, your home theater isn't the only place you want to watch movies or listen to music or anything like that. You've got a TV in the bedroom. Maybe you've got one, you know, in the kitchen, in the kids' room. What's the best way to get it around the house? What works well and not so well?
Well, it's getting better and better. I've got to say that. There's, in my house, Wi-Fi really does work very well, usually. But,
except when you're on the air, of course.
Of course. And actually, I do know about all those packets and stuff like that. And so I understand. Right. So you've got Wi-Fi, or of course you can hardwire your house if you want to hardwire your house, but that is always going to be your best, option, except that you're ripping apart your house and quite the expense. And then of course there's like those power line adapters, and for anybody who doesn't know what a power line adapter is, what it is a device that you plug an Ethernet cable into. So you plug an Ethernet cable into the internet TV or your computer or the NAS drive or what have you. And then you plug the other end of that cable into this device. Now you take the device and you plug it into the wall, and it uses the electrical cables that you have
to transport the data.
The household, your household copper wiring that just usually takes your electricity now is taking all of the data. And then it picks it up in another place where you can now connect that other adapter to your router.
So now it's
sending it from your router to the device, and you can have a whole bunch of them.
Right.
I've always heard this
likened to sending data, high speed, lots of data over the power lines, as driving a Ferrari on a dirt road.
Exactly. And the dirt road, the ruts in the dirt road are actually created by your refrigerator and other electrical devices that are
throwing... Your air conditioner that kicks on and sends a huge spike down the system.
Exactly. You need to have it nice and even, and to have kind of a clean line in between the two where the interference doesn't happen. And I recently had a conversation with Sigma, and I still have not found out what the full name of it is, like Clearwire, Clear something. It's a new chip that they're going to put into these power line adapters, or actually what they want to do is put it in the devices themselves, so the device actually becomes a power line adapter of its own. You plug it into the wall, and it will use its own power to send both the data and the electricity from one place to another in the house.
That's kind of cool. When will we see those kinds of products? Maybe this year, next year?
Well, I mean, Sigma has the chips available, and they said that they expect to see stuff by next summer. I didn't hear a lot about it at the show. There's also WHDI, which
I was going to ask you about wireless HDMI, which is one version of it. Have you had much experience with that? I haven't.
Well, no. They're just coming out with the adapters now. And again, they want to build it into devices too. On the WHDI, you're actually seeing the screen. You can have your whole computer screen onto your television, or you can hook it up to a Blu-ray player, and it'll send the signal from the Blu-ray player anywhere in the house and be able to see it on another screen. It's supposed to be very fast, no latency, so you could actually do it with a PS3 or something and move it around the house. They have a few different devices. You know, the device... There's the LG TV that you put on the wall with the wireless media center that has WHDI that you're hooking up all of your devices into it, and it wirelessly is sending it to the television set. Mm-hmm. So there's different things that are coming out. There's also new routers from Netgear and actually Samsung that are doing what they call priority QoS, quality of service, which means that it has a higher reliability rate. So things like the dropping out of my voice, but when you're talking about the dropping out of audio and video, that doesn't happen as much with these new AV routers that are really boosted up for this purpose.
Yeah, I heard Samsung talk about that they were actually coming out with a router, and I guess it's sort of aimed at media primarily. I mean, it could be used for just data as a normal router, but and they also had some feature on it where any compatible device that you bring within a foot or 3 feet or something of
one
this
foot
router
connection
wirelessly just sort of negotiates with it and goes, oh, okay, now I know where you are. And it will then be joins the network. You don't have to do any configuration or anything weird. That was pretty cool.
It is pretty cool, isn't it? I mean, so if you get a new Samsung Blu-ray player and you get a new Samsung home theater and you get a new Samsung TV, you stick the router in the center of it and it says, oh, I know about you guys. And then after a few minutes of it doing its thing and configuration, now you can take that router and put it over where the modem is and it'll still talk to it. But, you know, there's another thing I've noticed, too, that is making things easier with different Blu-ray players and newer network media players. And that is that they are catering to some of these routers that have the one button security, I guess is what you call it. Mm-hmm. So you press the button on the router, then you click something on your setup and it will do it all so that you don't have to be putting in all of your odd passwords and things to make it all connect. They actually automatically connect. So getting a router that's an AV router that's got the push to connect kind of thing is really highly recommended if you're putting all this stuff together now.
Excellent. Well, one more question then. What do you see coming down the pike? What can we expect in the future for all this? For example, physical media. Are we seeing the decline and death ultimately of physical media in favor of online streaming? Will we ever see 4K online?
Well,
a lot of questions there, I know.
Well, 4K, I mean, let's just see if we can make it through 3D.
You know?
3D is next. So let's see how we do with that. I mean, we've just, you know, baby steps, 1080p now and 7.1 Dolby Digital. I talked to Dolby at CES. So that sort of thing. Death of media. Well, if I'm any indicator, you know, I prefer to have a hard drive sitting on my desk rather than a big bookshelf behind me. And things like there's so many new ways of delivering where you are getting all of that extra, you know, bonus content that you can get it from. Apple TV has a lot of bonus content when you buy one of their high definition movies or DivX TV and things like that. They are able to give you all of those extras that you always were happy to get with the Blu-ray player. So now you don't need to actually own the Blu-ray in order to get all those extras. So
wow.
You know, there's some people who are going to feel more comfortable having something that's in their hand, or people who don't have a fast connection, which is getting to be less and less people. But I think that it really is the way that we're going to go towards the future.
Certainly, we are seeing an increase in available bandwidth. I mean, you yourself have, what did you say, 60-some megabits
65
down?
Megabits per second.
I mean, that's pretty darn good. I'm not sure that that's real common yet. And I know that the U.S. lags behind a lot of other countries in terms of generally available bandwidth, which is going to be one of the most important factors in whether or not online streaming becomes the predominant method of delivering high def, particularly content. You need a lot of bandwidth to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you only actually need about 3 megabits per second or more to get a high definition signal from or movie from Netflix. You only need about 3 to 5 megabits per second.
Well, still, that's got to be a lot more compressed than a Blu-ray, which is going to give you a high def movie in, you know, 20 or 30 megabits per second.
That's true. I've seen really good quality. And you know you've been there in a face-off with me. I'm pretty particular.
Well, so, there's no doubt about that.
But, you know, at about 10 or 20 megabits per second, which I'm seeing around Los Angeles and major cities, it'll take time. You know, it's not disappearing overnight. There still are people who are buying the Blu-ray disc. But even look at Netflix. They're really cutting back on their mail order service. They're now doing mostly the streaming and offering people just streaming. So that has to be a indicator of what's to come.
Yeah, it sure does. Well, Barb, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a fascinating conversation. And I look forward to having you on again sometime.
Absolutely. I look forward to coming on. And thanks for having me. People can find me at simpletechguru.com or to looking up network media players on about.com.
Fantastic. Just exactly what I was about to say.
I beat you to it.
You beat me to it. Yes, indeed. So those are Barb's online homes, and you can go check out her stuff there. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Robert Rich, a composer and performer of electronic music that several listeners have asked for. So I'm really looking forward to talking to him about surround music, how he creates his music. He does some great performances in the Bay Area, some of which are called sleep concerts that last for hours and induce some interesting dreams, I've heard. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation. And I sure hope that you'll join me for that. Until then, geek out.